Matt's is.
Thank you. Good morning, and we are going to open the February 26th House Transportation Committee for our informational meetings, and we'll have two informational meetings and presentations today, and the first one is an update on the passenger rail quarterly report. So Hal, if you'd like to come up, thank you very much.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Hal Gard. I'm the Rail and Public Transit Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I appreciate being here today. I was before this committee in November just providing a general update on passenger rail. I was asked to come back because of some unfortunate events that we had in December and the results that have occurred to our ridership. And really what I was going to start off by doing was this conversation was prompted by our quarterly report, and there are questions on why you get quarterly reports on passenger rail. Mm-hmm. There we go. So I just really wanted to kind of briefly go through pieces and parts of that. So House Bill 3401 was passed at the end of the 2015 session. And basically, it directed ODOT to study and make recommendations to do three things with our passenger rail program. Really to develop a marketing strategy around strategies to boost ridership and strategies for boosting tourism through passenger rail. We were required to report to the Oregon Legislature on November 30th of 2015. There we go. I got to roll back. And then we've provided a quarterly report every quarter since that initial report date. What we learned quickly was what we needed to do was improve our on-time performance. That was one of the key pieces. And really, we needed to get the word out about our overall passenger rail program better. So those were the two efforts where we focused. Just a quick reminder, Pacific Northwest Rail Corridor is one of 11 federally designated high-speed intercity rail corridors in the nation. It is operated by Amtrak. It goes under the name Amtrak Cascades as opposed to Amtrak. We have two long-distance services that also occur in this state, but ours is the Amtrak Cascades. It is paid for by the states of Oregon and Washington jointly. Oregon has about a 20% share. Washington has an 80% share. And it links the 18 cities throughout what we call the Cascadia Mega Region. It extends from Eugene, Oregon, all the way up to Vancouver, British Columbia. Don't have the ridership that we'd like to have along this 467-mile corridor in Oregon, but we're expecting to see the population of the state grow about 35% in the next 25 years, and as that population increases, we expect to see more and more ridership. And if you think about the dependence that we see on the East Coast and some of our other larger metropolitan areas, we expect that to eventually evolve in this area too. So we hang on to it and do what we can to promote it. I'm wrong. There we go. We think of the passenger rail corridor in Oregon as really part of a trunk line of a broader interconnected intercity service statewide. We try very hard not to compete with commercial services that are doing well. The only place where we duplicate service is along the I-5 corridor between Eugene and Portland, and that's just sheer demand. So we run point bus services to augment our train services to kind of fill in schedule gaps, although there are Greyhound services that run as well as Bolt. Other areas, and the blue lines point out other point bus routes where we've lost commercial service. We provide commercial service so that we've got those critical intercity connections for our citizens, even though the ridership isn't what we'd like to have. We think they're important enough to be able to connect those communities that we go ahead and do that. Okay. We saw some pretty serious on-time performance efforts, and we have struggled back and forth over the years. We instituted a bi-monthly call with the host railroads, our partners up in Washington, Amtrak, to really try to figure out what the problems are and what we can do jointly to address those. What we see here in July is we had a small derailment July of this year, and that led to that ridership drop as we had to adjust equipment, get our train picked up, and move back to facilities in Seattle so we could prepare it for shipment back for repair. That took a big hit on that July ridership. We had some serious maintenance programs that Amtrak was doing in the Willamette Valley in the October-November time range, which annulled a lot of our trains. We replaced those trains with buses. There's just a pretty big segment of the train ridership program that won't take the buses. We got most of our ridership back in November. The Thanksgiving time period is one of our biggest ridership months. And then, of course, we saw the major derailment on December 18th, and we took a pretty serious hit because of the just lack of equipment, disruption to schedules, disruption to service, and then ultimately the lack of confidence that that derailment provided. This just kind of parses it a little more closely. Most of the on-time performance issues originate from southbound trains out of Washington. If the train's originating in Oregon, our on-time service is really, really good. But there is so much congestion, so much competition for train slots throughout Washington that we have those southbound delays. And it was one of the reasons that Washington was making that huge hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of million dollars investments on the Point Defiance bypass was to try to alleviate some of that freight congestion, shave off some of the scheduled times, and add two additional round trips. And that new bypass was scheduled to open on December 18th. We've had ongoing efforts to optimize ridership. One of the biggest changes we did were starting to work with our schedule changes. 2014, we instituted, when we first started to see a drop-off in ridership, we instituted a schedule change trying to optimize travel opportunities in the state so that we had a morning southbound and an evening southbound and a morning northbound and a morning or evening northbound so that we had two round trips a day across the state. Just because of slotting and other factors, those early morning trains left very, very early in the morning, and they were just not being utilized. After the 2015 session, we were directed to change our schedules. Knowing that we were going to have to change our schedules again in 2018, we opted for a pilot to try to figure out what were going to be the optimum schedules that we could put in place. And so on the weekends, we made a much later northbound trip a slightly later southbound trip from Portland. And we got pretty dramatic results. That morning northbound trip on that train out of Eugene, we saw a 71% ridership increase. And in 2016, when we did the morning southbound, slightly later departure time, we saw a 26% increase. So we thought those were quite favorable. And those were the schedule changes that we were going to put in place once Washington added their two additional round trips. Additionally, we've been reaching out to many of the tourist groups throughout the valley. Our trains are bike-friendly. We produce bike brochures and try to market our services to folks on biking excursions. We offer discounted fare. The buy one, get one are quite popular, and we distribute about 10,000 of those a year. We have an onboard magazine which highlights fares and opportunities throughout Oregon, trying to build upon some of the good outwork that the Oregon Tourism Board has provided for us. Here are just the details on the schedule change all the way around. They're subtle, but they matter. So, these are currently instituted, even though we don't have our connectors from the Washington trip, and I'll get into from the Washington trains coming southbound. I'll get into that a bit. but we previously had a weekend later departure. Now we have a weekday later departure southbound out of Portland, and with a slightly later weekend departure date. Nothing changes in the evening. And then northbound on the evening, we have just a slighter half-hour later departure time. But we expected pretty big returns off of those schedule changes. Here's our overall ridership. It peaked in 2013, and then we started to see our declines. Our declines are really tied to three areas that we can tell. One is much, much, much lower gas prices. It's been just cheaper to drive your car, and folks opt for that. We started seeing some increased competition in the corridor. That was when Bolt Bus came on board, and then during that time period, there was a huge investment in infrastructure by UP in the Willamette Valley in that 2014 time period. And that, coupled with our schedule change, we were having a lot of conflicts with UP freight traffic. It took us about a year to sort that out, but we started to see trends in the right direction. Here's a little more detail on what's happened over the past couple of years for us. We had a consistently higher ridership in 2017 over 2015, but in 2016 we did not quite meet those numbers. That huge spike you see in August, that was special trains we put in place to deal with the eclipse, and I think it's pretty good evidence that we can respond to major events, and we think about the opportunities that additional train service can provide when we look at something like the World Games coming down to UP a little bit later. And that gives us a little bit of a tool to maybe buffer some of the congestion we see on I-5 from those major events. Particularly since Eugene also, as we get in and look at that event a little harder, they don't have enough hotel rooms for the amount of folks coming in. So if we're able to move people between cities and spread out the impact of that kind of tourism impact, it can be a good tool. So we're working closely all the way around. And then you see in December, you see that big hit that we took from the derailment. And let me get into that a little bit more. On December 18th, it was the inaugural run of the new Point Defiance Bypass, the inaugural run when Washington was going to add their two additional round trips. At 7:33 a.m. in the morning, that train left the tracks. I can tell you what happened. The cause is up to the NTSB, and it's still under investigation, so there's a distinction between what happened and the actual cause. But the train hit a 30-mile-an-hour curve at 70 miles an hour. The train derailed. Train consisted of two locomotives, 12 cars. 11 of the cars were owned by the state of Washington. The head-end locomotive was owned by the state of Washington. The back-end locomotive was owned by Amtrak, and the cab car backed by that back-end locomotive was owned by Amtrak. The locomotive and many of those cars left the overpass, landed on I-5, closed I-5 for 57 days. We had 3 passengers killed, 62 injured. 8 were injured in the 14 vehicles that were involved on the interstate. Injured were immediately transferred to local area hospitals. It disrupted service. Washington made the choice that they would discontinue any more traffic on that new bypass until positive train control had been established throughout that section of the corridor. We concur with that, and work has started to make sure that we are going to meet all of the required schedules by the implementation date that is federally mandated by the end of December of this year. So we're pulling in representatives from all parties involved. That's the major railroads, that's the major hardware and software companies, and I'm actually leaving here and flying up to Seattle to engage in those scheduling conversations to make sure we're lined out. Positive train control, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, it's been fairly mandated and have had due dates extended over years because the technology has not quite kept up with the need. I guess that's the best way to put it. And it's a system where you have on-track sensors that are coupled with sensors on individual piece of equipment, and that all of that is worked by backroom servers so that Amtrak dispatching is coordinating with the dispatching services in Omaha or Fort Worth, Texas, where the major freight railroad dispatching centers are. So all that stuff has to talk seamlessly together and make sure we know where all the trains are. For the freight service down here in Oregon and UP, I have been assured many times by the Union Pacific Railroad that their positive train control system is up and running on their freight railroad system. The Washington locomotives are supposed to be compatible. The two train sets are owned by Oregon. We are currently retrofitting those with the appropriate hardware within those cab cars. So our train that's being repaired back in Milwaukee right now is having that positive train control equipment put in place. Once that train is back out here and back in service, our other train, the Mount Bachelor, will be taken out of service and that hardware will be put in place. There will be a testing period throughout the corridor and make sure that all the pieces talk to each other before that bypass is reopened. Pausing train control is a good thing. It would have prevented some of the other accidents that occurred shortly after ours. It certainly would have or should have prevented this accident. Mm-hmm. It would have prevented the accident that occurred in South Carolina where the train was shunted off onto a siding into a freight. It won't do things like when a garbage truck drives around barriers in front of a speeding locomotive. It doesn't work for those things. The human error factor on those circumstances are hard to take out. Although I do have to say, and I'm a little amazed, Amtrak Cascade service operated since 1994 with no major derailments, no loss of life from anybody on a train for that entire period. But in 2017, we've had two derailments that have been caused by Amtrak, and those have been the source of some very serious conversations between my department and Amtrak. What has happened with the safety culture in Amtrak, where all of a sudden we have two derailments in 1 year? They have a new CEO, Richard Anderson. I spent a day with him on January 5th, and my director spent time with him at the end of that day, and we were pretty clear about our concerns. And he made it very clear that the state of Oregon is not going to be held responsible for any costs or loss of revenue that are the results of this derailment, that they are putting definitive steps in place to deal with the safety culture in Amtrak. And one of the things that allowed me to leave that meeting with a little stronger sense of commitment from him is that he was the chairman of Delta Airlines for 25 years. And if I think most of us around this table are old enough that we remember we used to have a problem with crashing airlines for quite a while, and we have not seen a major airline accident in a very long time. And a lot of that is because of very definitive, deliberate steps that the airlines put in place to change their safety culture. And so he has put a direct appoint vice president to him, who's in charge of changing that safety culture, and he has committed to regular updates. I'm going to stop there and see if the committee has any questions.
Any questions? You have one. First, we have Representative Wilson and then Representative Vile.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might have a couple of follow-ups, if you don't mind. Hal, let me ask you, how long do you think it's going to take to gain ridership confidence again?
Yeah. Representative Wilson, Chair McLean, thank you for that question. Good news is we saw a precipitous immediate drop-off in December and into January. We are starting to see our numbers come up. So already February, which is our lowest ridership month, people aren't tending to take trips, we've seen more ridership than we did in all of the month of January. Mm-hmm. So I think folks are seeing the trains running. We're getting them back on time. We're down 18% overall the entire corridor, but we are starting to see things tick up. I think when we add those two additional round trips and we start our through train service, once we get the positive train control in, I think we're going to see pretty dramatic increases in ridership. We intentionally did not change the schedules we put in place to accommodate those additional round trips from Seattle, even though they're not occurring, because there's always a little dip in ridership when you do a schedule change before people get used to it again. And we did not want to do the flop back and forth, changing a schedule here, chasing schedules, because that just chases people away. I'm pretty confident that we're going to see our ridership coming back fairly quickly. I really believe that.
If I may follow up, wanted to ask a bit about the the loss of equipment. Mm-hmm. How do we operate missing that much equipment being taken offline?
Yeah, we are at the raggedy edge of equipment with having one of our train sets out, and it'll be coming back in March, so we'll be up to six sets. Amtrak has committed to replace the lost equipment, and right now they have provided what's called protect equipment. And that equipment now is just running, we call it a captive train, and it's just running between Seattle and Vancouver. back and forth, so it's providing that leg. So the other equipment, the Washington equipment, and our current running train is running between Seattle and Eugene on its kind of regular rotational work. So we can do it with five trains. It takes a toll because of the maintenance requirements. It will be really hard when they add those two additional round trips, so we need to be back up to a full consist, seven trains. And so that will be one factor that'll make sure that we have to have that in place before we get back to those additional round trips south and out of Seattle.
Yes, please.
Ask about positive train control, just so I'm clear on this.
Right.
So the only tracks that don't have positive train control now would be that cutoff, the shortcut, if I may call it that, where the accident occurred.
So technically, all the pieces, except for our two Oregon-owned train sets, are in place on the sensors. The trackside sensors are in place on the bypass. The trackside sensors are in place on throughout the entire Washington system up into Vancouver and all the way down into UP. What's missing really are the back office servers in Amtrak that are up and running and talking to all the parts. That's the holdout. And the conversations that are happening this week are, what's the schedule? What's, you know, when are those servers going to be up and talking? What's the testing schedule? What's the missing hardware components that we need to make sure we have in place that all work together? That's the complicated component. And I will come back at the end of this week with a detailed schedule that we'll be able to hold all the parties accountable to.
Okay.
Yes.
When you talk about safety culture that the airlines have that the railroads apparently do not have, I mean, is that a good statement to make? Because it seems like they're light years ahead of the airline industry is miles ahead of the railroad industry in safety features.
For clarity, it was the statement made to me. And the distinction that Mr. Anderson was making in our conversation was that the safety culture that is kind of currently run by the national railroads is one of a freight rail system. And that when you're moving people, your standard of care is much, much, much higher because you've got bodies on board. And so it's not one of, oh, you didn't follow the protocol, I'm going to punish you and you might lose your job. It's now, no, you have to be trained. There needs to be simulators. There needs to be more hours spent making sure that we really know what the process is. And if you see problems, report it, and you will not be held accountable for that. We will take what you told us, and we're gonna incorporate that back into our culture. That seems to be the shift that he's pushing for, and you know, of course, the proof's going to be in the pudding.
Final. I have a relative who's a pilot for a major carrier here in the U.S., and I'm amazed at the amount of time that they spend in simulators over and over and over, practicing everything that could possibly happen. So I'm just kind of amazed that the rail industry is not closer to that. But I understand the issue about carrying bodies versus freight. But with that in mind, final question for me on this. I don't fully understand the relationship between railroad industry, between those who carry passengers and those who carry freight. Does freight have a priority over a passenger schedule?
No, it does not, Representative Wilson. Here's the issue. Passenger trains do have priority. However, there are frequently areas across the rail network where you do not have sidings long enough for the very, very long freights. And so the shorter passenger trains are the ones that end up getting shunted just because of lack of opportunity to pass. But legally, freight has our passengers have the priority over freight.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you.
You bet. Representative Vial.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hal, what's the cost of that 20% that Oregon's contributing to this system?
Totally?
Yeah.
Our biennial budget for 15-17 was just under $30 million.
Okay. And what is the cost per trip versus our fare recovery?
Yeah, so cost per trip changes, and I've answered this question many times, and I have to put a little clarification. When we do our subsidy analysis, we do the whole kit and caboodle. It's all of our costs minus all of our revenue. Or all of our costs, minus all of our revenue, which is not, so if I give you my numbers, they don't compare to Washington's, they don't compare to Amtrak's, because they don't do it that way. They do it on a pretty strict percentage they just calculate it differently, and we can't compare numbers. I'm just going to leave it there. So, and it changes. We do it on an annual basis, and it basically changes. But it has trended between 118 and 120. Dollars a ride, which is a pretty high subsidy. That's the subsidy. So, and if you put it in percentages, we're below 30% recovery. It has been higher than that in the past. Washington's is closer to 66. So, if you do it in percentages, their recovery rate's quite higher. One of the reasons, and I want to emphasize this, that we were excited about the schedule change with Washington is that we were going to see significant savings. So there were two estimates that we were given. One, we were going to see about 167,000 additional riders a biennium because of the efficiency comes from those through trains. So you're not stopping at a station waiting, picking up another train an hour later like any kind of airline railroad. The train you get on will take you all the way through from Seattle to Eugene. And that was the idea of marrying up those trains for those through trains, and we were, the estimate was a significantly higher ridership. I'm going to come back to that in just a second. The other piece was because all of the train miles for the additional round trips are occurring in Washington, so they're running more equipment in Washington. The train miles, overall percentage of train miles, are much, much lower in Oregon. So we're going to increase ridership, and we're getting fewer train miles, which was going to net us a savings of about $102 million a year. I'm taking those numbers to Amtrak as part of our cost recovery negotiations and say we built our biennial budget around those numbers that you gave us based upon those two new round trips, and we expect that we're going to be held harmless around that. So what I would expect if we're successful in those negotiations and we get those round trips back and we start to see some of those returns, that subsidy number is going to go way down. By that amount. So I just wanted to, that's background in terms of that, but yes, our subsidy is high.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Let me ask it a different way. Mm-hmm. What percentage of the seats are occupied on an average? Let's just leave it at on average.
I'll have to do that calculation for you. And it just, some trains are fuller than others. And they're full at different times of the year, so we'll have to calculate that out for you in terms of percent. We're about 30% full, and that's a guess, but I'll get you actuals.
And we've been at this since 1984, as I understand it.
1984, and we've had. Where's my overall? Right there it is. Those are the overall ridership numbers. So we've had continuous about 10% year over year increase. If you look, in 2021, we added the second round trip, and we had that large spike. We had trains taken out of service around 2008 for a variety of reasons, and that's where we saw that decrease, and then we continued to see increases up until 2013. 2013 is when we start to see it dip back down. So we've had that increased ridership indicates demand overall.
Over this 30-year period, though, have we really ever seen our metrics, the ones I just asked you about, the cost per trip, the percentage seats filled, have they ever really changed?
It's not the same equation because in 2013, the federal subsidy went away, and that's when the states picked up all the costs. So we used to just write a check to Amtrak, and things happened. And we were able to cover it through our vanity license plates and a little bit of money we get from the TOF. So the calculations and we started generating subsidy numbers that reflect us only start from 2013. So to kind of figure out what the subsidy was per rider all the way back, is it's not apples and oranges.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll look for those numbers. Thank you.
I'll absolutely get them to you.
Representative Mekas next. We're going to try and only do about 3 to 5 more minutes on this one.
Okay.
We have a second informational, and I have one.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Hal, on page 5 of the presentation you gave us is more of the on-time performance.
Uh-huh.
And to me, we're at 70 or below. It spiked up in September close to 82% briefly, but on average, it's well below 80% for on-time performance. And I'm curious, do you have any numbers nationally for other Amtrak, you know, corridors, what their on-time performance is? What is our comparison compared to the performance standards around the nation? Because to me, if I was your CEO saying, you know, we're not really performing well, how can we expect to increase ridership if it's not reliable? And so those are some of the questions I have.
Yeah, Representative Chairman McLean. Nationally, I don't know, and I will see if those numbers are readily available, and I'll be hanging out with Amtrak folks to see if they have an aggregated. One of the reasons with the on-time performance, as I indicated earlier, that southbound train out of Seattle is what hangs us up all the time, pushes those numbers down on average. As I said, if they're originating in Oregon, we're doing okay. That's one of the whole points behind that Point Defiance bypass. That's why that major infrastructure change was so important, and it was to get the passenger trains off that freight track that runs along the Sound. So it was, you know, cutting off a significant amount of time and alleviating some of that freight interference. So it's frustrating to get a new piece of infrastructure in place to alleviate a persistent ongoing problem and then have it immediately out of service because of this accident. So on-time performance for 2017, for this year already, January is we were at 71.4%. February we're back up to 78.1%. So we're trending slightly back in the other direction. But I agree with you. On-time performance is a problem.
Okay. Anybody else with a last question? You don't have to answer these today. I really have an interest, I think the whole committee does, on making sure that we are up to date on this part of our transportation system. And also, how do we do a better job with ridership and subsidy and those issues? To me, there's so many issues to deal with.
Yes.
You've got the ones that I know of, and I know not hardly at all anything about this area, is the fact that you've got the side rail issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big issue in Oregon. I think it's a big issue anywhere, but it's a big issue in Oregon. We've got the fact that we've got California and Washington with double tracks and triple tracks, and we have a single track. We have issues with the fact that you've got trains that have certain ownership, you've got rails that have certain ownership, you've got interstate issues. All of those are big things.
Yes.
And so it makes me wonder, just have we spent enough time really thinking about our master plan, our overall, you know, scheduling in a big way for both short-term and long-term, you know, improvements. The safety issues, I think that is something that sounds like the whole industry is behind a little, and that we're going to suffer a little with that just as much as any other state. And so that's something that we're all going to have to get behind to try and make sure we've got the safest system possible and that we're working on that. But to me, I just want to see where we are really thinking in a creative way on both, you know, partnerships with private and public, partnerships statewide, and then also trying to figure out how do we deal with the single rail issue.
Right.
I don't think we can improve an enormous amount without some real work on that single rail issue.
Chairman McLean, I could not agree with you more. We should very shortly, hopefully in the next 6 months or so, be landing our corridor improvement plan and EIS for passenger rail for the state of Oregon. And basically it argues for an incremental approach. You grow ridership by having schedules and frequency that folks want to use. I mean, that's one of the biggest issues. And we're a minor player. I mean, they've got more riders than they've got seats between Portland and Seattle. We have more seats than we have riders between Eugene and Portland. But I see it coming, and I think there's quite a lot of folks who see the population coming into the valley. Valley and recognizing that we need to have options. So we got to get smart about it. We have to find a way to make the critical investments and to grow the service, or we'll end up being forced to. I think that's what's ultimately going to happen. So.
Can I just finish up with the last? We had Go Rail, a lot of you. Did you get have somebody come in that was from Go Rail, had to deal with the freight that was nationwide? And one of the issues that they brought up that I also thought was interesting was the fact that there are now these train companies that are trying to use each other's, you know, tracks, and they're trying to do it in a particular fashion with a particular process that sounds murderous to our overall system as far as keeping any schedule, whether it be freight or a passenger or anything else. Do you have a comment on that?
It is a complicated business, and it's a holdover from structures that were put in place 150 years ago, and the agreements between short lines and the long freight carriers, and it's a private industry, and we operate on top of it. It's a challenging environment. It really is.
So, well, thank you for being here today, and thank you, committee, for allowing us to have this informational. And we, when you want to come back, know you're welcome.
Well, I'd love to come back when we have our corridor improvement plan in place, and I can share what some of the long-term thoughts are.
That would be great.
Thank you very much.
And we'll quickly get on to our second informational. And I want to thank Paul for being here today. I'm going to close the informational on passenger rail, and I'm going to open an informational on the mega transportation projects. And Paul Mather from Highway Division, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I'm going to talk a little bit today about some major projects that we have around the state. Obviously, it's not going to be a comprehensive list. I've just picked a few of them to illustrate some of the work and some of the thoughts that are around the state when we talk about major projects. I will also point out, and I'll talk about this more in my presentation, in House Bill 2017, there was a provision to create a task force on mega projects. That task force has yet to be stood up, but it has a specific charge of defining mega projects and talking in the state about how we go about funding those projects, as well as defining those projects. So I'll talk about that a little more in my presentation. I thought I'd start with the Portland metro area and the congestion relief projects. We talked about this a little bit when we were here last Wednesday and talked about the cost to complete study for I-205. And I think this gives you a little better background of just so what are the projects that we have already funded, planned in the Portland metro area. And this map just shows those projects that we have either underway, in design, or in some way funded, headed for construction. So I'll just talk briefly about each one of those. Starting at the bottom of the page there, the I-5 southbound and I-5 northbound auxiliary lanes. These are projects you're going to see under construction this summer. We have a major paving project that will also build these auxiliary lanes. I'm going to talk a lot about auxiliary lanes. Auxiliary lanes are where when you get on the freeway, you have a dedicated lane that goes all the way until the next off-ramp. And so the through lanes remain the same, a number of through lanes in those segments, but you have an additional lane for that weaving to occur between the interchanges. And from an operational standpoint, they have great efficiencies and improvements where we don't have to go and remodel the interchanges themselves to make the structures longer to accommodate additional lanes underneath those interchanges. It's a very efficient way to increase the operation of the freeway. One of the key aspects of the southbound auxiliary lane in this case, it will complete the auxiliary lane that will go from Highway 217 to 205. So when this lane is completed, you will have a dedicated lane from 217 southbound all the way to 205, which should greatly improve the operation in that section. On Highway 217 itself, you'll see we have two projects for, again, additional auxiliary lanes, northbound and southbound. These are two projects that were funded in House Bill 2017. They will be in the 21-23 timeframe is when they are slated in the bill to be construction, and we'll obviously have a great improvement on 217. Kind of continuing around clockwise around the map there, we're completing under construction additional widening on 26 out to Cornelius Pass. That project is under construction, will be completed this summer. All the orange that you see on here, that is the traffic management, the active traffic management project. We talked a little bit about that as an element of I-205. You see that on 217 today, and that's, again, a very efficient way for a relatively a very small cost to have an impact on congestion and just reliability of the system. One of the biggest things we found on 217 that it does, it just reduces the amount of rear-end crashes. Those rear-end crashes, we know, cause immense backup during during congested times, and just the reliability of your trip, not knowing the amount of time it's going to take you to travel from one point to another through that section. We've reduced that reliability time, and so you know more certain how long it's going to take you to travel through those corridors with that system. You'll notice the kind of the striped piece there around the Rose Quarter. I'll come back and talk about that here in a minute. Moving over to 205, those are the auxiliary lanes, Representative Vial. If you remember the question you had to us on Wednesday, Ryan was describing those auxiliary lanes, and those are the ones that will be under construction this summer and next summer to complete those two pieces. Sunrise Corridor, there's a little piece of an auxiliary lane that we'll build as connection with that project. And at the bottom, the 205 project is not funded, but we did the cost to complete study. So a little bit about the Rose Quarter project. Again, really what this project does is completes those auxiliary lanes. It does not provide additional through lanes. There's still two lanes that go into this section and two lanes that come out of this section. It provides a through lane from I-84 that connects to I-405, both northbound and southbound through the section. It does quite a bit of improvements on the local system, creates better circulation, as well as bike ped opportunities through this section. This project is funded through House Bill 2017. There was $30 million set aside. We will use that $30 million in bonding scenario we're still working through. As we noted last Wednesday when we were here, we're a little bit behind where you saw the work we were on 205 as far as our level of understanding of the project and the exact sequencing of the project. But again, it's not funded until out in the 2022 timeframe in the House bill. I-205, I think our presentation last Wednesday covered that project, but just a reminder, that's another major project in this area. So I'm just going to skip around the state and hit a few other projects around the state. Newburgh-Dundee is a major project in that area. The portion in orange you see on here is the piece that we just opened up. It does provide a bypass around Dundee in Newburgh. What you see on the map is what was or what is in the environmental document for the entire project. It's a four-lane facility, limited access through this section. The piece that we've completed was only two lanes, but it has the ability to be expanded to four lanes. In the time frame it would take to do all this and the sequencing, this project is probably approaching $1 billion to do everything that was envisioned in the environmental documents and the real dollars of the actual dollars of when we would construct those. In House Bill 2017, there was money to do the design work for what's called Phase 2. And this is the connection from 219, or the end of the piece we've completed, back to 99W. So there was some money set aside for design, but not for construction of that section. So River Crossing, a major project here in Salem. A lot of discussion around just where the connection, do you need a major project, what are some of the alternatives. I just included this one because we do have an active environmental study going on in this area, but there's a lot of discussion in the community itself around just the size and scope and footprint of this project. I-5 Salem-Eugene, one of the hearings that we had a year ago last summer, We had some discussion around the completing of or the continuation of three lanes south of Salem towards Eugene, and the importance of that and the need for that from a congestion standpoint. As we look at those and do some rough numbers of what that would cost, we're $1 billion plus probably in doing just that. About half of those funds would be in the Albany area, and just the need to remodel those interchanges. As I was talking about auxiliary lanes, if you're going to add a through lane all the way through, it really triggers the remodel for a lot of these older interchanges that were built when the interstate was originally built in the 50s and 60s, 70s. And so a lot of work to accommodate those three lanes and accommodate the need for those interchanges. On the north end of Albany, and this is connected to the Millersburg site in the Connect Oregon, just as a reference point for you, would be a new interchange there in the center of the screen that would be in the vicinity of that intermodal site that's considered under that's under consideration. Moving down to Eugene, the Beltline Highway, there's a daily congestion. If you've ever experienced that on Beltline around Delta, on a daily basis, we have a backup, and again, crashes that occur in that backup. We're doing some of the same techniques I described in Portland to alleviate that, but the bigger project that's envisioned here is one that provides additional capacity on the Beltline, as well as remodel the River Road interchange, as well as the Delta interchange. The large bottleneck is in the crossing of the Willamette. It's a two-lane structure, again, with very short weaves from the interchanges on either side. Part of the project is in yellow here, would provide a local access so people would be able to cross the river without having to use Beltline itself. This project is envisioned in the $350 to $400 million range for this project. Highway 97, as we toured again around the state, the most common theme was fixed congestion in Portland, specifically 205. The next thing that, at least that I heard most commonly, was Highway 97 and the need to make investments in Highway 97, both for the communities along 97, but just strategically for the state to provide an alternative to I-5 and a way to get freight and goods north and south in the state without having to go through the I-5 corridor. We have been working, as we have opportunities, to provide passing lanes on 97 to increase the capacity. Most of those passing lanes have been built in the area that I've got highlighted here, kind of in the central part of the state, where it's fairly flat, easy terrain. If you move to the south of here and you get around Klamath Lake, you have some challenges in widening, as well as the north end of the corridor in Cow Canyon and Spanish Hollow, where you've got just geographic constraints and cost increases to deal with that. There are other improvements in the corridor. If you've been over there in the Sun River area between Sun River and Bend, we've recently completed a four-lane section with limited access. There's plans to take that further to the south, but still looking for funding for that. The other major project is on the north end of Bend, where Highway 20 comes in. This is a rendition of what that project would look like. Today, as you come north on the on the parkway around 97, you go in front of all the stores there in the area along Highway 97. The envision would be to build a bypass basically around that and move 97 next to the railroad tracks and bypass that. This project alone, again, in what's envisioned in the environmental document, is around $200 million. There was $50 million for a phase of this that was in House Bill 2017, and so we'll be working on that. It's in this area around Cooley Road is where the $50 million will be focused. So those are just a few of the projects from around the state. Again, I remind you, in Section 121 of the House Bill 2017, there's a task force of mega projects that was created to put more definition to this. What I've provided you today is just some of the kind of the highlights around the state and some of the things that we heard about as we did tours around the state. And obviously, these are highway-focused projects. As you heard from Hal before me, there's needs on the rail side, transit side, or the other aspects of transportation, not just on the highway side.
Thank you very much. Yes. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, question for you about right-of-way.
when we're looking at all of these projects, do we already have rights of way for all of these projects, or is 97 kind of a different animal and it requires it?
Chairman McClain, Representative Wilson, in most of the cases, we do not own the right of way, especially for what we're envisioning. In some cases, say in the I-5 widening, we're able to widen in the center median and put a barrier up. We wouldn't need additional right of way. In some of those areas on 97, we may have purchased wide enough right of way where we wouldn't need to purchase more. But most of the interchange projects, certainly the North Corridor project in Bend, all of those type of projects we would need right away. And a lot of those are in developed areas where the right of way would be very expensive.
Well, okay, thank you. And if I might ask one other thing here, and that is, have you heard anything about labor shortages with any of the contractors that we deal with for our large projects and expect to deal with? Anything about labor shortages among contractors?
Representative McClain, Representative Wilson, I've heard some things, but I think that's probably a better question for contractors to answer directly. What I will tell you, in the projects or in the bidding schedules that we see, the amount of competition that we're seeing is less than what we typically see, specifically this time of year. Now, what's causing that, whether it's labor or other things, I know there's a lot of work in the market, both on the private side and the public side for contractors. The amount of competition that we're seeing in our bid openings that we've had in the last 6 months have been less than what we typically see.
To that point, when we had the congestion pricing subcommittee, we had all the contractors in that couple evenings, and their comment was that they're moving them, so there may be a lag in a project that's causing them to move them here later.
Yeah.
But these are folks that are from Oregon that have gone to other states to do work and then are wanting to come home to do this work, is what we were told during that particular meeting. So I think, again, like you said, it's work.
Right.
It's work out there and getting them from one project to another. Representative Vial.
Not just labor, Representative Wilson, but material. I mean, that would... We just saw another $6 a ton increase in gravel last week up in the metro area. So it's a big problem. My question is this. I didn't hear you say anything about congestion pricing, about pricing the actual cost of our system, maybe even in advance of building the system. But certainly I'm wondering if that's a conversation that's actually occurring internally in ODOT versus just the hearings that we're having and trying to gauge public sentiment. Has there been a specific conversation in your department in the agency about that?
Chairman McClain, Representative Vial, there's been a lot of conversations around tolling, congestion, pricing. Stems from, again, the House bill making having expectations that we have that conversation with the public and develop alternatives for the I-5, I-205 corridors and take a look at those corridors and the feasibility of pricing in those corridors. So we're not only having that discussion in public that you've seen us out having public hearings, as well as the committee that's working on those, but obviously we're having discussions internally as we prepare for those discussions and other possibilities in the department.
Just one more.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one last question. Looking at this presentation, and I appreciate that you couldn't be comprehensive, but I did not see anything that specifically addresses the Hillsboro, what I'll call the Hillsboro problem,
right.
the isolation of what is essentially now the state's key economic driver from not only the rest of the Portland metro area, but north-south travel as well. And wondered if you can address what ODOT is doing to try and come up with solutions for that.
Madam Chair, Representative Vial, so the most of the projects I talked about, I think all of them, are work or represent projects at least connected to some environmental work that we have underway. That environmental work was started based on local plans and local planning processes that are underway in those communities. So in the area that you're talking about, again, we would be responsive or be working with those responsible for land use planning in those areas to develop those kind of long-term plans, get into an environmental document or get into more detailed discussions around a particular project. But we would, again, be working with those that are responsible for the land use changes in those areas to work as transportation and land use work together.
Can I translate that to say you're waiting for instruction from the local jurisdiction?
Chair McLean, Representative Vile, I wouldn't phrase it that way. I think it's more of a team effort. We work together, and so as kind of partners in the conversation between land use and transportation, we'd come to the same conclusions together.
And is that conversation taking place with the key leadership in Hillsborough, Washington County, et cetera?
Chair McLean, Representative Vile, we have those conversations with all our partners continually.
And Region 1, I mean, the Region 1 work we're talking about too, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, Madam Chair, I apologize, but my point kind of is, and I'm being a bit rhetorical in that, is that I don't see anything going on in the J-PACT conversations that is really addressing this issue.
Okay.
And that's a concern that I have.
Okay. I know we're getting down to the magic hour here, but I wanted to just put a couple of things in from yours on my part. The auxiliary lanes, the passing lanes, the safety issues that you're talking about are key. To me, they're, you know, top priority. And part of that is because of the automation that we're facing here in the future and getting some of these vehicles and people and trucks on and off these facilities. And, you know, we've just talked to Daimler and their platooning experiment and testing and really trying to figure out, you know, with these long, you know, what I would call platoons, that how are we going to safely get folks on and off. So as you're looking at the auxiliary lanes that you're building in, the passing lanes, you are considering some of that future technology that we're going to be dealing with, I'm assuming.
Chair McLean, it's hard to keep up with all the technology that's happening, but it's certainly as we build those active transportation management projects, those are things that we have in mind as we build those, as well as the auxiliary lanes. Again, just keeping up with the technology.
So we're hoping to get a task force or at least get a more active work group working on automation and all of those types of things that are, I know that ODOT does have an advisory committee on. So I look forward to hearing more about those as well.
Good.
Any other questions? Thank you so much, Paul, for being
here
today.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Mr. Brennan, are we done with our
Do we have another presentation in this mega projects? We have some materials that are on OLIS.
Yes, so Madam Chair, we did receive materials that are available on OLIS. I was not aware of them until I arrived this morning, but they're there for the committee's review.
Okay. At this time, I didn't know there was anybody else. I didn't know we had a sign-up sheet.
We didn't. Mr. Courtwright is in the audience. He's the person who provided that those materials. So.
Well, we have about 3 minutes. And sir, this is more of an informational for the committee, and we'd be happy to have you come back when we're actually dealing with this as an action item and or further information. I hate to have had you come all the way down here
for a non-hearing
meeting. So please, you've got 3 minutes.
Members of the committee, thank you. 3 minutes is very generous. I appreciate your time is very valuable. And I would have been here to hear this presentation in any event, so no problem. I participate in a group called No More Freeway Expansions.
Oh, your name is...
I'm sorry. For the record, I should know better as a former committee administrator. For the record, Joe Courtwright, and I'm with No More Freeway Expansions, which is a citizens group in Portland that is concerned about all of the projects that are proposed for widening freeways in Portland, but particularly the Rose Quarter. And I want to make just 2 points very briefly. First of all, while the legislature intended in 2017 to expend more than $1 billion to widen freeways with the idea of reducing congestion, we know that specifically with regard to the Rose Quarter widening, that project will not reduce the daily recurring congestion. And that's not my assertion. That's actually the results of the work that's been done by Oregon Department of Transportation and also by City of Portland. So you'll spend $1 billion or $500 million in that corridor. It will not measurably reduce daily congestion on I-5. So that's the first concern I have. The second point I think that we would make is, to Representative Vile's point, It's critical that if you're going to do road pricing, that you do it before you invest $500 million in additional road capacity. And I'll just tell you a brief story from Louisville, Kentucky. And Louisville built the equivalent of the proposed Columbia River crossing. They spent $1 billion widening a freeway across the river from 6 lanes to 12, carried about 120,000 vehicles a day, just the same as I-5 does. And after they spent their $1 billion, then they put in a $1 to $2 toll for commuters. And when they put in the $1 to $2 toll, which is a very modest toll, they saw the traffic on their new double-sized bridge drop from 120,000 vehicles a day to 70,000 vehicles a day. So, and I could show you, and it's in materials that I presented, it's a basically empty roadway during the peak hours, which meant they wasted $1 billion on infrastructure that they didn't need, because if you ask the people who are using it to pay even a fraction of its cost, it wasn't worth it for them to make the trip. So, as you oversee the mega projects, and you think about the timing and implementation of road pricing, I think it's critical that you insist that ODOT do the road pricing first and then decide whether and where you need to invest in additional capacity. Thank you, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. And we're gonna keep this too, if there's a burning question. Okay, thank you for being here today. We're gonna have further discussion on all of these issues.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, at this time, is there anything else for the good of the order, Mr. Brennan?
What's our next?
Take a minute. So we currently have nothing on the agenda for this Wednesday, I'm sure.
Okay. At this time, we'll be talking. We have a vice chair meeting at lunch, so maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. Again, if you have any other ideas or feel like we need some information on a particular part of the transportation system, let me know, and we'll go from there. So thank you very much for being here today, and we are going to close the informational on MAGO transportation projects and also close the Transportation House meeting for today. Thank you very much.